You're listening to Nearly Departed. This podcast is entirely written, edited, and produced by me, Katie Wiggins, so please shoot me a review if you're enjoying it. Thank you so much to everyone who has already reviewed. Your words mean so much to me. If you want to represent Nearly Departed, head to the link in the description for TeePublic, where I have some awesome designs you can get as merch. There's one with a vintage ghost photography in it, which I really love. And now, without further ado, Chapter 5, The Brownstone. Dear Miss Kandinsky, I want to tell you about the summer I spent in New York. My name is Angela Testa. I was born and raised in Stamford, Connecticut. I had been training with the New York City Ballet and in 1982 was brought into the company. A few weeks before rehearsal was set to begin, I was looking for a place to stay in the city, and a friend from the ballet company mentions that she's looking for a roommate. I jump at the chance and meet her at the address she gave me off of Central Park, and I was stunned by the place. It was a brownstone building that I figured would be an apartment. All these old brownstone mansions had been sliced up into apartment buildings eventually, but she let me in, and all three stories were one home. She owned the whole thing. She takes me into the first floor parlor, and the furniture is this curly-cue, overwrought Victorian style, but it's threadbare, and there isn't much of it. It almost looked like the set for a play, where a single rug and a chaise lounge are sort of meant to indicate the rest of the fanciness in your imagination. I grew up in Connecticut in the 60s and 70s, so I've been in a lot of very wealthy friends' homes, friends with nannies and help around all the time. But this home looked neglected. The thing people don't realize about big fancy mansions and castles and things is that maintaining these huge properties is the real show of wealth. It's not easier to live in big places, it's just showier. And when you can't afford to maintain them, the cracks start to show very quickly. So I'm in this big brownstone mansion, looks like a museum. The wood flooring is this very intricate pattern in every room, and my friend, her name is Everett Fish, is a doll. She's very sweet. But she also looks like a doll. She's very willowy, your classic Balanchine ballerina. But she has this little round face and this sheet of slightly frizzy long brown hair to her waist and these big round eyes. She's a great expressive dancer. She had gotten into the company a year before me. We didn't know each other all that well, but had trained and performed together a few times. I asked, and she told me that the house had been in her family a long time, that until about 20 years ago, several maiden great-aunts or cousins had lived there for their entire lives, and when they both died within moments of each other, it was found that each of their wills bequeathed the home and the rest of their meager fortune to different people, beginning a drawn-out legal saga over who would inherit the property. That side of her family contentiously fought over wills and codicils and soundness of mind and all that. And eventually the home landed squarely on Everett's shoulders. Her mother, Agatha Sherman, was the old women's niece. Everett smiled at me then as she told the story, assuming I could connect the rest of the dots myself, and asked if I minded birds. She had a parrot named Limoncello on the second floor parlor. After I reassured her I didn't have a problem with Limoncello, she beamed and offered me a very low rate for rent. I quickly agreed and shook her tiny hand. A weight seemed to have been lifted from her, so much so that I had to ask, "If you can live here for free, why do you want a roommate? You know, is there a catch?" My home in Connecticut was stacked full of siblings, and I just couldn't imagine passing a chance for peace and quiet. She seemed to sort of shudder and said that she gets lonely in the big house. After that, she took me on a tour. The ceilings were tall, but the rooms weren't as big as I had imagined. It seemed like every room could be sealed off with pocket doors, those rolling doors that slide into walls which felt odd to me. I thought it probably had something to do with conserving heat in the winter. She shows me to her room on the second floor, this imposing four-poster bed and wardrobe and a poster of Olivia Newton-John, which was so funny to me because it was so out of place. There was a large parlor area on the second floor whose windows faced the street, which had been a library because the back wall was entirely bookshelves stuffed with books that looked about 100 years old, as well as a few popular paperbacks that I imagined Everett had read, which she stacked above the thick books in their proper places. Limoncello was there, facing the window in his cage. This must have been the most used living room, I thought, because a squashy chair that didn't quite fit with the rest of the sparse Victorian furniture sat near the parrot's cage facing a television. She also had a record player on the coffee table and many stacked notebooks and paperbacks scattered on the cushion of the bay window facing the park, as well as an overfull ashtray. Every floor, the stairs got narrower and narrower, and the rooms got even smaller, until we reached the servants' quarters in the attic, whose ceiling slanted in on the rooms. The tiny, rusty old beds of the servants were still there, which was kind of shocking to me, and in one of the rooms it looked as though a servant had merely stepped out. The desk, chair, and wash basin were there waiting for their return. There was a distant sound of a doorbell, so Everett started her descent down the stairs and told me to pick out a room. I followed down the stairs back to the second floor. I walked down a hallway past the narrow staircase and opened one of the doors she hadn't shown me. It was incredible. It didn't look at all like the other anemic, stripped rooms. It was very well furnished. The bed was smaller than Everett's, but incredibly ornately carved with a thick canopy falling behind the headboard. The walls were wallpapered a delicate floral pattern of white and pink, and I remember a huge dollhouse was in the corner, on this pink cushioned little stool. There were large pink trunks strewn about the floor. One was open, and I could see that there were children's clothes and dolls inside. I just couldn't understand what I was seeing. It was like a little girl's room had been frozen for 50 years. There were even linens and pillows on the bed. This is so strange looking back on it, but I went into the room, pulled back the duvet, and sniffed the sheets. It smelled so odd, so strange. I will never forget it. They definitely hadn't been changed in years. There was also a tiny little white vanity across from the bed, with silver hairbrushes and combs, all muted with dust. I felt strongly that I was intruding, or like I had walked inside a church. The atmosphere was incredibly heavy, so I get out of there pretty quick. I didn't want Everett to see me inside, and I found another room, just like Everett's, off of the library, big and blank. I didn't bring up the girl's room to her. At that time, I'm not sure why. I'm able to move in quite quickly. My dad dropped me off with a few boxes, and I tried my best to make my room feel homey, with candles and pinning up scarves, but everything I have gets swallowed up by this space. My parents replaced their rug, so they gave me their old one to put in my room, which helped a bit. It was also very hot that summer, so the windows stayed open most of the time, and the overhead lights off. The house smelled like dust and warmth and cigarettes and the remnants of a million French press coffees. My first night there, I felt like I was in a castle. I couldn't sleep a wink. I felt like I was being watched so strongly. I figured it was just part of leaving home for the first time and that I would get used to it. But you could hear every slight creak and footstep in the house. Often Everett would walk down to the kitchen in the night for a snack or water or something, and I could hear every single step all the way down the stairs and back up again. A few nights after I move in, my eyes just open in the middle of the night. It's freezing in my room. Freezing. It's June. It shouldn't be this cold at night. My window had just been open, so I get up to close it. As I'm closing it, I hear my door creak open behind me. I turn, getting ready to be scared by Everett, but there's blackness in the doorway. I tell myself something about the draft, of the window pulling the door open, but I'm terrified. The next day I have off, and Everett is in rehearsal, so I decide to invite over my friend Ron and cook a big lunch together. I've just gotten back from the store, and I drop off the groceries in the kitchen, which is a room behind the staircase when you walk in. Ron calls and says he's about to leave his apartment, which is a 15-minute walk away, so I run upstairs to primp before he gets there. I decide to try to squeeze in a shower. It was hotter than usual that day, especially, so I rinse off, get dressed, and rush downstairs expecting to see Ron on the stoop. But he's not there. So I just hang out in the front sitting room bay window, looking out onto the park and smoking. Nothing. 30 minutes pass, so I give him a call, and he answers at his apartment. I say,
"Where are you?"
He says,
"Your roommate told me to leave, that you were sick."
I'm totally confused. Everett isn't home. She hasn't been home since 7 a.m. I say,
"What the hell are you talking about? Tell me what happened."
He says that he walked up to our door, rang the bell, and a girl answered who told him I was sick and that he should go home. I have no idea what to make of this at all. The house is totally silent. There's no one home. I ask him to describe the girl. I'm thinking of the little girl's room upstairs. And he says she looks like a teenager, like 15 or 16, and that she's very, very slight, very thin, and dressed strangely, out of date. And now, what's at the back of my head comes to the front, and I think, is this house haunted? I grab the groceries and walk to Ron's place. I need a break from the house. The next few days are quiet, but I find myself in moments straining my ears to listen for someone in the house. In the middle of washing my face, as I'm reading a book, I'll just stop and look around, like I'm trying to catch someone looking at me. One evening that week, Everett and I are finally in the same place at the same time, which almost never happens. We're watching TV in the second floor library parlor.
Announcing Sunoco's sundial service now.
Hey, you're feeling outnumbered at noon.
And I ask her if anything strange has ever happened to her in the house. She looks shocked by that question, but she says, "I can't imagine what you mean." So I try a different track. "So your great aunts used to live here," I ask. "Did they have any children?" She still seems very tense by this line of questioning. She says, "No, they never married." I wait for her to elaborate, but she has glued her eyes to the television. So I let it go.
The German Alps, where the Audi 4000 feels right at home.
Another night, not long after, I wake up again in the early hours. There's someone in my room. I was on my side, and I kept my eyes closed. But I could hear someone standing on the side of my bed. The shifting of their feet and their breathing. I'm horrified, but I try my best to keep my breathing low and my eyelids relaxed. I open my eyes just barely, and in the darkness, I can tell that I'm not looking at Everett. I say the Our Father and Hail Mary over and over until after an eternity I hear footsteps leading away from my bed. The door doesn't open, but I can just tell the thing is gone. I call my mother the next day, and she is incredibly disturbed by what I share. And she says that she'll have my aunt, who lives in the city, to come over as soon as possible to give me saints, medals, and crosses for the doorways. This is supposed to be the most exciting part of my life. My career is starting. I'm on my own for the first time. And I manage to move into a haunted mansion. So I meet with my Aunt Marie for lunch a couple days later, and she adorns my room with Catholic protection. She gives me holy water, medallions, a statue of the Holy Mother. She and my mother can't understand why Everett's family would just leave her alone in the big house and thinks the situation is very typical WASP. And my aunt starts bringing over these large baked pastas and dishes every week as well because she's convinced Everett and I don't eat enough for the amount of rehearsal we're doing. But I want it to work. I want it to work out, and I defend Everett and I defend the house because this was the first big choice I ever made on my own. And it felt important to me that it work out. After my aunt gave me all of this stuff, I don't remember anything coming into my room after that, so maybe the crosses and statue worked, actually. Our rehearsal schedule was incredibly intense, so I spent little time during the week in the house, and I tried to spend my downtime in the park. But while the house repulsed me, the mystery of it also fascinated me. I found Everett one Saturday afternoon feeding Limoncello, and decided to pry a bit more out of her. "So did you grow up here with your mother?" I asked. "Oh no, I grew up off of East 70th, she said. "I didn't know my mother." "Really?" I asked. "Yes, my father and my stepmother raised me. My mother died when I was a baby." And then she changed the subject, as she always did. And none of it made any sense to me. It was shortly after that Everett found Limoncello. Early one morning, as I was putting makeup on, I heard a scream. I thought Everett had hurt herself, so I rushed out of my room, right into the library, where Everett was crouched on the floor near the television. "What's the matter?" I asked, and she turns back to me in agony and asks me if I did it. I'm shocked, and I say, "Did what?" I come closer and see that she's pointing to the top drawer of the small dresser that she had been using as a TV stand. Inside was the large, still, vivid green body of her parrot. I'm speechless. I say over and over again how I could never do anything like that and how horrible it was. We put his body in a shoebox and bury him in one of the garden patches of the courtyard in the back. The next day, the cage was on the street, and when I tried to talk to her about a home intruder or how the hell it could have happened, she just iced me out. Maybe she still thinks I did it. But in what universe would a normal person do something like that? How could she possibly allow herself to believe something so strange? Things are quiet for a while after that. And my intense curiosity about the house's history overpowered my fearfulness. One morning, Everett was spending the day with her stepsisters at a family function in the Hamptons, so I decided to do some investigating. I had my coffee and eggs, and then steeled myself to go into the little girl's room again. As I walked in for the second time, it felt like the room was sleeping. I didn't sense anything strong or bad, except that it was distinctly colder than the rest of the house. So I decided to start looking for evidence of who had slept there. I looked through clothes and dolls and children's mystery books from the 50s until I finally found a series of school notebooks in one of the trunks. In neat but unsure cursive, the books were labeled as belonging to Agatha Sherman, Everett's mother. So she must have lived here as a young girl. I couldn't get the timeline straight in my mind, but young Agatha had definitely spent time here at some point, and she must have been very, very young. I remembered my own mother went to school in the 40s, not the 50s. But why had this room been abandoned in childhood and not touched since? She can't have died as a little girl because she had to have Everett. Maybe they were just so rich that when she moved to a new home, it didn't occur to anyone to fix up the room. But that didn't sound right to me. The school books revealed nothing, so I continued to look around. And I really wish I had stopped there. After another trunk of dresses, I noticed a trunk under the bed. I slid it out from its spot and popped open the shiny buckles. In deep shadow, I couldn't tell exactly what I was looking at, but disgust registered immediately. I slammed the top shut again. My heart was pounding, and I lifted the box onto the bed, into the way of the light from the window, and I opened it again. Inside were the delicate bones of an animal skeleton on a blackened silk pillow. It felt like something had gripped my stomach from inside. Looking at it more closely, it looked like a cat skeleton. I thought I heard the front door open in the distance, so I panicked and dropped the top of the trunk closed again, buckled it, and slid it under the bed. I retreated to my room and waited for more sounds of Everett's presence, but there were none. What the fuck was that cat doing in that little girl's room? There were little toys and cards in there, among the rotted pillow and bones and whatever else was left over. It looked like it might be a good little coffin for a pet to be buried in the ground, not out and under a bed where the smell would have been unbearable for weeks. There's no way anyone could have lived with that smell under their bed. Whoever the girl is, she must have left after she buried her cat. But another part of the trunk's interior clarified in my mind after I calmed down. The inside of the surface of the trunk had been ragged with scratch marks. I hadn't put it together at that moment. That cat had been alive. Limoncello's body in the drawer crashed into my mind. I had to get out of this place. After that, I began taking steps to move. No amount of cheap rent was worth this. I didn't understand the house, and I didn't want to anymore. Understanding it could never make it less menacing. I started quietly asking around, and I begin to get my things together. But I'm noticing that I can't find several pieces of clothing that I wear all the time. Things I knew I had folded in my drawer the day before were gone the next. I didn't have the energy to really investigate it. One day after all of this, I'm in my room polishing and packing up some shoes. I hadn't told Everett I was planning to leave. For some reason, it just didn't feel safe to. As if saying it out loud was dangerous, because whoever was there would hear it. I'm on the floor of my room, listening to my Carole King record, as I always did. It smells like shoe polish, a sandalwood incense cone that I had lit, and the cigarette butt on the windowsill. My window is open, into the back garden, a story below, and I can hear kids playing in the apartments facing my window on the other side of the courtyard. I suddenly hear footsteps slap past my door and rush around the corner, down the hallway, behind the stairs. I freeze. I can't remember if Everett was home or gone, so I call her name. I don't hear anything. I open my door to call it again, and a bra that I had been looking for days is on the ground a few feet past my door. It hadn't been there 15 minutes before, when I had walked out of my room to grab something from the library, which is right outside my door. I steeled myself and picked up the bra and began to walk the path of the footsteps that had run past to the little girl's room around the corner. I turned the intricate metal knob of the heavy wooden door, and I push it open. At first, I think a girl is laying on the bed on top of the covers. But as my eyes adjust to the darkness, I see that it's not a person, but like an effigy or a doll made out of clothes. My clothes. My blouse is wadded into an oval for a face, a pair of tights carefully arranged as hair around it. My sweater and a long skirt must have been stuffed with other clothes, and a pair of my shoes creep out from the skirt and point towards the ceiling. My body experiences a terror I don't know how to explain, and I feel a hard yank on the back of my hair. I wheel around, and there's no one behind me. But there is, because I can feel her laughing at me. I run to my room, grab everything I've packed, and shove the rest into my fitted sheet, which I bundle up, and I run out of the house. That was the last time I ever went inside that brownstone. Years later, when I was passing through New York, I decided to meet up with a friend I was in the ballet company with, Rachel. We did all the catching up on our lives and then moved to gossip about our mutual friends, and she said, "Didn't you live with Everett Fish?" "Yes, in a big creepy brownstone off Central Park." "You're kidding me. You lived in the Mead murder house?" "Give me a break." But she goes on, "No, Angela, that's what we used to call it. It really is, I swear," she said. "Everett's father and my father were friends when we were kids," she said. "We lived on the same street. Our nannies would dump us together all the time. She didn't live at the murder house, though. It was just her family's. And when I told my mother I didn't want to hang around her anymore, she told me she agreed because Everett's family was so screwy, and coming from my mother, that really means something." Rachel went on with her story. She said, "My mother told me that Everett's mother, Agatha, came from serious, serious money. Very old New York. My mother told me she was just dropped off to be raised by relatives and nannies until she was old enough to travel with her parents. And the last place she gets dropped off is with her two spinster aunts at the Mead House. And they've had a wacky reputation for decades. The house felt like it was the 1880s inside, apparently. So Agatha moves in, and after a few years, gets pregnant really young with Everett. And her parents want her to go abroad for an abortion. But the aunts sort of pull rank because she lives with them, and they want to have the guy responsible, and Agatha, marry, even though she's like 14 and he's in his 20s. And Agatha is also a very odd girl. But that's all my mother ever said about her. So they postpone the wedding until after Everett is born, in secret. And then one day, Agatha is found dead in the Mead House, her stomach full of arsenic. It was ruled a suicide. The family said it was ongoing illness and health problems. And baby Everett lived with her mother's old nanny for a while until custody was given to her father. My little friends and I thought her father was the one who poisoned her mother because he didn't want to be married to a crazy little girl. But who knows what really happened? I couldn't believe what Rachel was telling me, but at the same time, it made horrible sense. I had always felt as though I had stepped in on a silent family drama in that home, playing itself out in the shadows around me. "How did your mother know all of this if it was a secret?" I asked Rachel. Rachel smiled. "My mother's cook's sister was the housekeeper for the Mead House. The help," she tapped her temple. "They know everything." And that's the end, for me at least. Maybe the ghosts are still knocking around in the Mead House, or maybe it's a CVS by now. But I'll never forget my time in the brownstone. Thank you, Angela Testa. You've been listening to Nearly Departed, written, produced, and edited, and performed by me, Katie Wiggins. Keep yourself warm by the fire. Have your first season's hot cocoa. I already have. And I'll see you next time, my little creeps.